Hello and welcome to Gascast. Coming up this month, we're going to continue this podcast's relentless Remy Fentanyl bashing by reviewing a case report from March's Anesthesia and discuss the latest AAGBI guidelines on post-anesthesia care units. We'll also be talking again about gastric ultrasounds because it is a thing, and looking at prognostication in traumatic brain injuries. We've got discoveries, biology of bunkum, all served with a side of ranty northerner. I'm Rick Thomas, and joining me are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Rebecca Smith.
Hello.
And standing in for Frank, we're delighted to welcome back Sibs Anwar.
Hello, everyone.
So, Sibs, thank you very much for joining us once again in Frank's absence. It's nice to have you back on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back. It doesn't feel like it's been more than a day.
And Bex, you're once again not at home and you're back on your travels, aren't you? Where are you this month?
I'm up in Liverpool. I've come up here to get trained by the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. They teach over 2 days. A set of skills for resuscitation of the newborn and obstetric anaesthetics. And there's about 20 trips a year out to different parts of Africa that you can go and set up these training camps and train local providers and hopefully make a sort of sustainable difference in obstetric anaesthesia. So yeah, I've come to the culture capital of the north to learn some life skills.
And are you managing to learn some life skills or just the exorbitant price of Stella from your hotel room minibar?
I'm aiming for a balance, 50-50.
Great. So let's crack on. It was all a bit last minute last month, and I'm certainly grateful to be back in the isolated comfort of my own room, where I can't see you all. But what's everyone been up to on the discovery front since we last met in Frank's kitchen? Mark, what have you got for us?
I've discovered something completely by accident just today, in fact. I think I might have mentioned around a year ago on the podcast, a tricky pre-hospital case I had standing beside a semi-frozen pond waiting to see if there was a person who'd fallen in, and having great difficulty making the decision about at which point does a search and rescue operation turn into a body retrieval operation. And this is a very difficult decision that sadly is far too frequent for pre-hospital providers, in that drowning is still a very common cause of death worldwide. It's a complicated issue deciding at which point resuscitation attempts would be futile, and it's even further complicated by stories that get popularized in the press whereby people have somewhat miraculous recoveries. There was a famous Norwegian case that's often mentioned where a young lady was in the water for a couple of hours and still made a full neurological recovery. And at the time I struggled to get kind of solid advice on the matter, but I stumbled across an editorial today from Resuscitation in 2011, where the author Gavin Perkins writes an editorial summarizing recommendations made in a large international consensus meeting. And in a nutshell, for people like me who are looking for pretty black and white definitions, the general advice is that people fully submerged in water greater than 6 degrees for more than 30 minutes or less than 6 degrees for more than 90 minutes are unlikely to survive, and it's probably therefore reasonable to not attempt resuscitation after those times. What I found really interesting about this consensus report was that they described their methods as a pseudo-systematic review, and pseudo, when you read between the lines, means that instead of sticking to the stuffy methods that you academics prefer, they also included a wider range of sources in their literature review, to which I think they mean the Daily Mail Online.
Awesome. In those guidelines, where would that Norwegian woman, who I think is actually she's a radiologist, isn't she, at the local hospital?
I think she was some kind of medic, yeah.
Yeah, where would she have stood on that?
Well, I guess if you were to follow this as a rigid recommendation, she, would not have been resuscitated. But I think it's widely accepted that they're exceptional circumstances, in that she was athletically fit and was in extremely cold water, so it was probably rapidly cooled prior to the cardiac arrest actually happening. So, like all guidelines, these are by no means rigid, and there certainly has been a little bit of correspondence following the editorial. So I would never rule out unusual circumstances, but just to have have some numbers in mind that are put together by experts in the field is quite reassuring when you could end up in this situation.
In this sort of field, all sort of evidence and systematic review is always going to be pseudo-systematic. It's going to be difficult to design studies and therefore come up with the absolute answer in a controlled manner.
Right. So just simple things like the water temperature in, for a start, most things are case reports. And in those case reports, things like water temperature and duration of submersion are often estimated at the time. So right from the source, your data is flawed. But as I say, it's nice to have some kind of loose numbers to base these decisions on.
So, moving around, Bex, what have you got for us from the culture capital of the North?
Actually, my discovery comes from another part of the North. It was earlier this week, I was attending an airway conference in Coventry. And as part of this airway course, they were reviewing the management of airway disasters that we've all become a bit too familiar with. So primarily the Elaine Bromley case and the Gordon Ewing case. If you remember, Gordon Ewing was an unfortunate gentleman who died in Glasgow in 2010 during the induction of an anaesthetic. He was having surgery to correct the fractured distal phalanx of his little finger. The coroner's report from this is very complex. There was a lot of difficulty with the airway and numerous airway adjuncts were used. But at one point, he was successfully intubated with an intubating LMA. And as they were removing the intubating LMA, unfortunately, the pilot balloon sheared off. And they weren't able to use the tube that was remaining for ventilation. And so they had to remove it. And there was, you know, numerous other things that evolved. But unfortunately, he then did die. Now, we were shown quite a nifty trick that if you are ever in such a situation where your pilot balloon shears off, you can actually use a blue cannula. You take the needle out and the plastic of the cannula sits over the tubing that connects what would have been your pilot balloon down to the cuff, and then you can use a syringe to inflate the cuff. Now, I'm not saying that trick in that particular situation, you know, would have solved the whole crisis and that there would have been a different outcome. But I just thought it was quite something to have up your sleeve if you ever do end up in that awful situation where you have someone you've really struggled to intubate, use intubating LMA, and then shear off your balloon. And it may just gain you some time so that you can get control of the situation again and sort of, you know, develop a plan B or C or whatever it might be at the time.
Well, that's really interesting. So,
yeah, it's very cool.
Of course, you're not going to have a valve in your blue cannula.
No.
So you just put the blue cannula down the tube where the pilot balloon was, and then just inflate it with a syringe, and then just hold it there, presumably, or tie it off or something.
Yeah, I mean, they did show different ways of doing it. You could put a three-way tap. You know, you can between the two of them, so you can put some air.
That would be much more sensible.
But, you know, I think maybe in that situation, you may just get the ODP just to hang on to the syringe.
It's a neat solution, though, sort of Blue Peter style, isn't it?
Oh, I love a bit of Blue Peter.
That reminds me of an airway trick I was taught. So, you know, when you've got someone who's got a large beard and you might have difficulty ventilating them, you're not sure what's under the beard, and it's difficult getting a good seal on the mask. The trick I was told was, if you've got cling film handy, which you probably are less likely to in an operating theatre, but again, in the pre-hospital environment, you generally tend to be carrying cling film for burns. You can wrap that, it looks a bit strange, but you can wrap it all the way around the head and the mouth and the nose and the beard of the patient you're having difficulty ventilating, and then pop a hole where the mouth is, put a mask back over, and the mask actually makes a really good seal with the cling film, and then apparently you're able to ventilate them.
Sorry. I'm willing to give it a go, but I might practice one or two times on a normal intubation. It's all going very well.
And people are going to wonder what you're doing when you're sort of struggling to ventilate a patient, and then it looks like you're trying to murder them.
mummifying them in cling film whilst shoving blue cannulas down their cuffs.
Yeah, or is it some kind of strange S&M thing that you're doing? But yeah, you do that, pop a hole in, you can see how that would kind of work.
That makes
versatile
sense.
Versatile anaesthetist with many things up their sleeves.
Quite worried about when I remember you said this, Mark, but going back from pre-hospital care to an anaesthetic room, and in pre-hospital care you're carrying all of these really useful things around with you that you'd never think would be useful, such as rolls of cling film, and you know you're not going to be able to get hold of that in a hurry should you need it. But anyway, that's a spontaneous discovery of the month for me, because that was actually discovered about a year ago. But my other one is that JICS, the Journal of the Intensive Care Society, now have a JICS cast. They had their first one, I think, in January, or it might be in February, which was reviewing the January Jix. I think I'm right in saying Jix is quarterly. And you go to their website, and it's James Day and Shagan Olasanyu, who's actually written into this podcast before. Hi, Shagan. And they're both giving you the review of what's been going on in that edition of Jix, distilled down with some questions and answers, and it's very good, so check it out. You can get to it easily by just going to Google and just put Jix podcast in. So well done, guys. It's good to have another anesthetic ITU podcast out there. So, Sibs, what are you bringing to the Discovery of the Month party?
So my Discovery of the Month also took place today, and it's not really a Discovery of the Month. It is for me. I had a conversation with a general practitioner today who pointed out something that's not been known to them, but not really that relevant probably to hospital doctors, and certainly not to anaesthetists, and that is that the GMC is about to introduce legislation to prevent the use of off-label drugs, so the use of drugs that don't have a license for their use unless there's nothing else available, there's no alternative available. Now, you'd think for an anaesthetist this is not really that relevant, and I was talking to this GP about pain medicines, and there are certain drugs for which a license has never been obtained, such as amitriptyline for neuropathic pain. And it brought to our attention that although it's conventionally used and the evidence will never be sought at this late in the day, and certainly a drug company won't fund the licensing process, it would seem that from middle of the year onwards, GMC is going to advocate or make it difficult for these drugs to be used in a setting where there remains an alternative. Now, obviously, this has far-reaching consequences in terms of drugs that we do use in obstetrics and pediatrics, where the studies have not necessarily been carried out and licensing is difficult, if not impossible. And that could therefore be a slippery slope towards being unable to use drugs in those settings without a full bona fide license. So I thought it was interesting and certainly worth bringing up, although it may not be a discovery for everyone.
That is really interesting, and I think that's going to become topical within the next 45 minutes.
Excellent.
Is my prediction for the future. So, before we make Sibs' point topical, thank you very much for that. Let's crack on with Bex, your article, and the AAGBI have got some new guidance for us. So why don't you tell us all about that?
Yeah, so my news item is the latest set of guidelines that have come out of the AAGBI. And as you can imagine, they were published in anaesthesia in the March edition, and they're titled Immediate Post-Anaesthesia Recovery. These guidelines replace the previous set that were released also by the AAGBI, but in 2002. Now, the guidelines themselves, if you have a read, they are very well written. They clearly lay out a set of standards that we are supposed to aspire to adhere to. And there were several things that stood out. Firstly, there's a change in terminology. Whereas we used to have recovery rooms, we now have post-anaesthetic care units. But the second focus is the real emphasis on checklists and appropriate communication between members of the team. So again, a focus on those non-anaesthetic skills, those non-technical skills in anaesthesia. apart from this, in line with the NAP4 report that we had on airway incidents in the UK, the guidelines recommend that continuous capnography should be utilised in any intubated patient. This is different to the previous guidelines. They also say that the removal of tracheal tubes in the PACU is the responsibility of the anaesthetist, but can still be handed over to a PACU staff member. Now, that particular comment did surprise me a bit. Certainly, during my time in anaesthetics, I think there's been a really noticeable shift away from leaving endotracheal tubes in patients in the PACU. And I would have thought that actually handing over their removal to the PACU practitioners would be taken out of the guidelines. During my time in Toronto, we didn't leave any airway devices, not even LMAs in patients in recovery rooms. So to me, I still find even that, it's quite a different mindset. Although certainly in the hospital I worked in Toronto, we mainly used desflurane. So, I mean, you're lucky if your patient's still asleep as they're being moved off the operating table. The other issue I wanted to highlight from the guidelines was the recommendations that they've come up with should be standard and adhered to for all patients, and that they made a special mention of patients that are either having obstetrical procedures or patients that are having cardiology or psychiatry procedures like the ECT. And this is regardless of whether these patients have either regional or general anaesthetic. There's certainly hospitals I've worked in, it's definitely extremely common, and much more so than I would like to admit to, that patients who've had maybe instrumental deliveries or spinal anaesthetics for repair of vaginal tears have been admitted straight back into their rooms and not gone to a recovery unit. And I've never felt that pleased with this situation. And I feel really pleased that there's a guideline that you can at least say now highlights this need, and it really is an appropriate anaesthetic management. Yeah, so all in all, I think these guidelines are a worthwhile read. They give us a really good starting point from which we can audit our own facilities and our handover practices. And certainly they can act as a platform from which we can identify areas of weaknesses in our own institutions that we can work on and maximise patient safety. What did you guys think?
Have any of you ever worked somewhere where you can hand over intubated patients in recovery? Because I never have.
I have.
That occurred to me when I've read it, because quite often on your first kind of anaesthetic induction into a new department, it's one of the things I always ask, because I've worked at both. And at some places, it is totally verboten. If you're going to come in with a patient who's tubed, well, you just don't do it. You extubate them on the table. Whereas other places, it is acceptable, but you must be close by. But that can be starting the next patient. In my experience, it's a highly variable standard of practice.
So I worked in one hospital where it was common practice, and since then I've spoken to people in our region, and it seems to be the only hospital people come across. I won't name it, of course, but there is a hospital where people do leave patients in recovery intubated, with recovery staff go off to another theatre and start a new case, even on their own. But I went there from a hospital where we weren't even allowed to leave LMAs in, so it's quite a contrast for myself when I arrived there. But they've done is audit it. Based on that audit, they're happy that they haven't had any airway complications. Obviously, very unscientific, but nevertheless reassuring to the group of anaesthetists there who run the the recovery.
Or I suppose,
PACU, as you may call it.
Yeah, I mean, I have worked in two hospitals where it's fairly routine, but I suppose you have to choose your patients well, don't you? Maybe the slim 22-year-old has got a very good mouth opening or something like that, and that you would make sure that you're doubled up. But perhaps now, after the report of NAP4 and the fairly shocking incidents of airway disasters going on in recovery, I would assume that people are a bit more hesitant to do this.
Well, the irony of that, of course, is that it's often when you're not doubled up that you're keen to get on and start the next case because this list has stopped. And often you'd find in that situation, recovery, that the anaesthetist who was doubled up often didn't feel rushed and would accompany and stay in recovery with their patient because the other person was happy to carry on with the case. So there's almost a paradox there.
Yeah.
And Bex, you're the most obstetrical, to use your word.
I did notice that as well.
That's Canadian. That is Canadian. I cannot help it.
Well, that's a word like burglarize.
It's obstetrical. Like they have. Yeah, it's just. It's your.
Well, you say I'm going to start your obstetrical procedure now.
Because I have always found it fascinating when I've been doing obstetrical cases, such as you do a 2-hour suturing, and I find it remarkable that 1 minute I'm required to stay there to provide full monitoring with an ODP and everything, and then as soon as you wheel out of the door, nothing's really changed with the patient apart from 2 more minutes have elapsed, and all of a sudden they go to no monitoring.
Well, yeah, midwife takes over responsibility, so therefore quite a lot's changed, I guess.
That's what I'm saying. What is it about wheeling out of the door that changes the patient's requirement?
Well, exactly. It shouldn't. And that's why they should go somewhere where they're fully monitored. It's just, it really isn't acceptable that you can just go somewhere and you go into a room or down a corridor behind somewhere which may not have a monitor. And if the monitor is there, it might not have a SATS probe. It might not have a BP cuff. It really isn't good. And so now at least there is some sort of standard. And, rather you can say, let's adhere to the standard before we have a disaster than wait for one and then change your practice.
I think let's hold off on the midwife bashing for now.
I wasn't bashing.
There's a couple of bits of just wording that interested me. I agree with you. I mean, AAGBI guidelines are always very well written and very carefully thought about. But point 8 in the summary is that all patients with tracheal tubes in place in a PACU should be monitored with continuous capnography. The removal of tracheal tubes is the responsibility of the anaesthetist, which I think makes sense, and we've just talked about that a little bit. However, it then goes on to say later, the removal of tracheal tubes from patients in the PACU is the responsibility of the anaesthetist, who may delegate the removal to an appropriately trained member of the PACU team who is prepared to accept this responsibility. That doesn't quite make sense to me, because they've said at the beginning it's the responsibility of the anaesthetist, but then you can't delegate it to somebody who is then going to accept responsibility. If something goes wrong, then who is responsible for it? Because that's not quite clear to me.
That's wholly contradicting it, isn't it? And I think, I mean, ultimately, regardless of individual policy and trust policy about where patients can be left with which devices, the anaesthetist takes responsibility until the patient's awake, whether they delegate that or not. And I think the contradiction in this in these guidelines is not helpful. I think most anaesthetists know that if they do leave the hospital, go to the changing room, they are taking ultimate responsibility, regardless of what the hospital's policy is.
Yeah, I see. I liked point eight, and I was slightly disappointed with that paragraph because I struggled to interpret it in any other way than it's actually okay as long as that person is happy, which kind of counters the point. But apart from that, I think it was good. One thing I was particularly pleased with was the mention of that all PACU bed spaces should have 12 electrical socket outlets. I like that specificity. They should have 12. I'm a bit of a plug nerd. Have I mentioned plugs?
I feel you can never have enough.
Well, you can never have enough. And have I mentioned before my Plugs of the World website? It's not my
plugs. If you have, feel free to mention again.
It's not my personal website, but it's one of my favourite websites. I always check it out before I'm going on a holiday, so I know which plug adapter to take, because obviously I've got several. But the Plugs of the World website, I'll stick a link to it, does specify that the British standard 3-pin plug is in fact, although ridiculed by the rest of the world, apparently common jokes in North America are that the device they're attached to are actually smaller than a British plug, are a world safety standard.
Yeah, those American ones don't inspire much confidence to me.
They don't, but then they all take the mickey out of ours.
I thought you'd, Rick, you of all people, I thought you'd be a sort of a universal adapter kind of chap.
No, they tend to be. I've never found one which isn't, which doesn't sort of disintegrate after a while. I find the ones that just do one job, and you only actually need about five or six of them to cover most areas. If you look at my Plugs of the World, the Plugs of the World website, it becomes quite obvious. It's got a little map of the world, and it breaks it up into regions. There's also quite a lot of history with which countries have what type of plug, because you can tell which of them were parts of the Commonwealth, where any particular, who's been, colonizing where, by what plugs they use.
But you see, the thing is, it's not about the plugs, it's about the voltage. When I came back from Toronto, I bought myself a really nice travel hairdryer from Toronto, bought myself a really nice travel adapter at the airport, arrived in England, put my hairdryer into the socket, via this special adapter plug, turned it on and had flames coming out of the hairdryer because of the difference in the voltage. So I'm not so bothered about...
Why is that? Because I thought it was... Is it the voltage?
Oh, I don't know. Whichever bit of the electricity that's important, it might be... I don't know. It's not the same. Everything takes forever to charge there. The kettle takes about two and a half...
Yeah, it's because it's one... I think it's 120 volts. That's the problem.
Well, you're allowed to have a plug in the bathroom. I don't know how little...
That's right.
That's
a sign of a civilised free world, isn't it?
I know.
Same in Australia. You're allowed to have a plug inside the bathroom. They trust you to behave yourself and also take responsibility for yourself. One day, all that will be ours.
Awesome.
As an avid hairdryer, that's very important.
That's a fantastic 10 minutes of plug chat there.
That'll end up on the editing for sure. There's no chance that's going to sneak in.
Anybody else, any more to say on PACU guidelines?
Is that what we're talking about?
Moving away from plugs, we can come back to that later. Back to AAGBI guidelines. Any other comments?
Well, I think it's always difficult with guidelines because it depends on how well they're taken up. So something like this, there's an element of stating the obvious, but if individual trusts or the decision makers in those trusts decide to go off piste, then they'll go ahead and do that, as they have been doing over the years. I mean, I think this is probably a recognised standard of practice not to leave ventricular tubes in recovery, but nevertheless there are trusts still doing that. So I'm not sure how much pressure. It's just an incremental step that these guidelines may make a bit more difference in terms of persuading people or dissuading people.
Well, thank you very much for that, Bex. I think that's interesting. Also, good audit fodder for anybody who wants to do a quick audit. They can, if they're starting at a new hospital or have just started in February, you can pick that up, get on it, do an audit. You could probably complete a cycle if you're on a 6-month attachment. Always worth thinking about. So, SIBS, on to something completely different. I think we talked a few months ago about gastric ultrasound, pre-anesthetic, to look at your risk of aspiration. But that was doing just ultrasound. But I think now you've got an advance on this particular technique.
Brilliant. Well, I'm not entirely sure how much of an advance it is. Nevertheless, it's becoming more and more interesting and written up. The editorial that accompanies this talks about this being as a new technique, a novel technique for anaesthetists or anaesthesiologists. So this is a piece of work originally carried out by this group in Toronto, and essentially is looking at trying to determine the residual volume in the stomach of fluid. So the idea being that, it's very important to know if the stomach's empty, especially in the emergency setting or prior to rapid sequence induction. But also, if we are going to do that by the bedside at the point of care, that needs to be done by the anaesthetist. Now, the anaesthetist, as anaesthetists, we're familiar with ultrasound, of course, for echo and nerve blocks and venous access. But sort of over the last few years, other less traditional roles have been taken on by the anaesthetist, you know, that of fast scanning and pleural peritoneal or pericardial fluid determination in the emergency setting. And also, perhaps even more controversially, measuring ultrasound epidural depth or, you know, airway anatomy assessment with ultrasound. But this is the next sort of natural progression, the idea that we can scan the stomach and see if there's residual volume, whether it's a few mils, whether it's 10 mils, whether it's a few hundred mils. This group carried out a study previously, and, you know, regardless of the fact that they modelled and were able to validate their data set, were criticised for carrying out, A, in healthy subjects who have been fasted and therefore may not represent the patient group who may have a residual volume but also maybe secreting differently from healthy young trial subjects, volunteers recruited from the community. So they carried out another study where they recruited patients prior to endoscopy, not surgery, but endoscopy on an elective list, and randomized them to receive different volumes of fluid, so ranging from 0 all the way to 400. So going 50, 100, 200, 300, 400 mils of fluid. They also modified the way they measured it, so they standardized it, so it was fixed in, the patient was fixed in a right lateral decubitus position, and then they measured with ultrasound the diameter, the cross-sectional areas, with three-point measurement at the antral level. So the idea here is that by using the three standardized points with the patient in the standardized position, they were able to calculate or use a mathematical model which had been modified to estimate, calculate the residual volume of fluid in the stomach following ingestion of those volumes as described. The difference in this study compared to previous ones by themselves and others was that they subsequently followed that up with gastroscopy and clearance, gastroscopic clearance of stomach content. So therefore aspirated, suctioned up all the fluid they had given in that bolus as well as secretion and patient's own residual volume prior to swallowing that fluid. So a true study measuring the entire stomach contents and comparing them to the calculated volume of the stomach based on their standardized measuring points. And they found huge correlation between their measurements and the actual volume cleared from the stomach. So they're happy they've achieved validity, they've improved their model, and they've standardized the way to measure it prior to their, as compared to their previous study. So they've sort of reassured themselves and anesthesia and analgesia, this is a development, this is a technique that anesthetists can take ownership of, add safety to the care of emergency patients. And the therapeutic step here would be that if someone does have a residual volume, they can then have nasogastric decompression via nasogastric tube, which you wouldn't ordinarily do on any patient who came in without any knowledge of their fasting state. You wouldn't necessarily decompress every stomach prior to rapid sequence induction. So that's a novel sort of translation of this study.
Yeah, I remember we had a look at this last year. I think it was the same group. Sibs, did you say it was Perlis? Yeah. I mean, I thought their studies were really good. We were at the institution where I was doing, they were trying to learn to do them in obstetric patients. And certainly in certain patients who perhaps haven't followed the fasting guidelines or, you know, have come in unexpected labour, you know, it was really helpful to see whether we could carry on or whether we were going to try and wait a bit longer, you know, for gastric emptying to take place. I think it's another nice tool, isn't it, to have. I remember, Mark, I don't think you were so keen on it, were you?
No, I can't remember what I said last time, but having read this again, I still struggle to think of a situation where I would want to do this, because the need for RSI is dictated by whatever the clinical condition is.
But you see, the point you're missing, which I think Sibs pointed out, which I forgot from last time, is that a lot of patients aspirate on extubation.
So once they're asleep, assume they have a full stomach and drain it. I mean,
it's just in reality we don't actually do that. It's very rare to
Which is more realistic, perhaps, doing that or us all learning? I mean, this study's all very nice, boys playing with their toys, but this is one sonographer repeating the study over and over again the same way, in very prescribed positioning of the patient in healthy volunteers. How do we do that in real life?
The positioning I do think is something of a problem, because you can't get all of our emergency patients into a right decubitus position. But I think there's two translational points here. There's one, the one that Sibs mentioned, which is doing everybody after they've had their RSI and saying, okay, this person actually needs decompression, because I think there is a significant proportion of patients aspirate post-extubation. The other thing is with those patients who are in that grey area, you're not sure if you can use an LMA. They might be a trauma patient, but from many hours ago, who are technically starved, where they had morphine. I'm never quite clear on the rules there. And obviously, the way to play it safe is to RSI them and stick a tube down. But for whatever reason, that may not necessarily be what's best for the patient. What you want to do is what's safest, but also what provides the best kind of anaesthetic outcome.
What are you talking about, the rules? This ultrasound, are you telling me that you're going to start using an ultrasound and that's going to make the difference in your decision?
Yes. So, well, I'm not going to, because I'm not trained in doing it. But
that's what I'm saying. How many are you going to have to do?
So what they're also advocating, to be fair, is actually to ultrasound prior to intubation as well. So there is an argument for extubation, but their principal argument is to check the content of the stomach prior to intubation. So therefore to put a nasogastric tube in an awake patient or in a sedated patient to clear the stomach. So it is slightly more controversial. I have to agree with Mark. It's not quite as clear-cut as they make it sound in this idealistic study.
Yeah, and again, if you've got time to do all of that, clearly it's not a desperate emergency. So what's the benefit?
But not everybody is a triple A dissecting that has to, you know, RSI that has to happen in 5 minutes. There's plenty of people who are just appendixes that should come in, and should they be given RSIs? You know, all of these patients that are in the grey zone, it can just be another factor to help you make a good decision. Yeah. If you think someone is at, you know, huge risk of aspirating, maybe you would change your practice, you'd sit them up a little bit more, you'd be, you know, even if they were desaturating, you'd be, you know, more cautious to bag them, you know, admittedly with cricoid pressure, but it would have to be a modified rapid sequence. It's just something that gives,
I think, see, this just sounds like me to giving yourself a license to cut corners.
I think the skills point is a valid one, but I think there's certainly, I don't think we should get bogged down in the time issue here. I don't think this is something that needs to be done in an emergency situation. So with an unconscious patient or an emergency airway, they're advocating this for someone who's about to go to theatre and have a controlled rapid sequence induction. And the idea is that you do have time for an ultrasound. This is not for the emergency patient in the back of an ambulance.
Mark, it's all about minimising risk.
That's not the argument Rebecca just gave. Minimising risk would be sitting the patient up and not bagging them, whether or not you knew the contents of the stomach. This is about giving yourself a security blanket to cut those corners.
No, sorry. Okay, I'll rephrase that. It's about risk versus benefit. So you've got a young woman who's got some vague pain and they want to do an appendicectomy. She's not been sick. She doesn't feel sick. She hasn't eaten for 24 hours, but she has got a bit of a white count, a bit tachycardic. Surgeons want to do a lap appendicectomy.
Yep.
So you're charged with anaesthetising her.
Yep.
What sort of rapid sequence induction are you going to do? Are you going to do thiosux tube cricoid pressure, which would be considered safe and standard? And I would argue, and we've certainly been through this many times before when we did the myth-busting episode about cricoid pressure, the weak evidence behind it, and the discussion that it probably does more harm than good, especially in regurgitation. Or are you going to do a modified rapid sequence induction? Or are you going to do no rapid sequence induction and give yourself the best possible view with the laryngoscope, because in fact, an airway emergency is more likely than an aspiration. It's risk versus benefit. So what are you going to do?
I'm going to do what I would always do. What I'm saying is, I don't see how the ultrasound findings saying full, empty, or in between are going to change that. I'm going to give that patient a modified rapid sequence with my normal choice of drugs. And if her stomach's full, a stomach's empty, I'm going to take the same precautions.
So you're going to give her...
I'm not going to change what I... Okay. I'm not going to stick an LMA in because the ultrasound...
No, no, I'm not
empty.
Asking you to stick an LMA in. What I'm saying is... Okay, so a rapid sequence induction gives you suboptimal intubating conditions because you're going to use cricoid pressure. There's plenty of papers out there that show...
I didn't say I was going to use cricoid pressure.
Okay, I'm still going to make the argument it's suboptimal. We can talk about pre-oxygenation. But my argument, if I just follow it through, is that you've made the decision that the risk of an airway issue, you're prepared to have a suboptimal intubating conditions because you believe the risk of aspiration to be worse given the patient that I've just described. However, with ultrasound, that's added information which makes you may tip the balance in favour of, in fact, I'm less worried about the aspiration, but I'm more worried about the airway. So I'm going to give myself the best possible airway conditions I can, which might be a gentle anaesthetic, some bagging, careful positioning, no cricoid pressure, no worries, plenty of time for your non-depolarizer to work, and boom, have a look.
Let me be absolutely clear. I'm always going to be more concerned about the airway than I am about aspiration. Anyway,
but don't you think you'd want to know in an
airway?
Are
you telling me that you would bag this lady based on your ultrasound?
So you may do. You may buy yourself time by allowing yourself to bag the patient because you've reassured yourself the stomach's empty.
But if you needed to, you wouldn't bag her because the ultrasound said the stomach was full.
No,
yeah,
I'm not.
But it's not
going to
be the only decision in your argument. Don't you think you'd want to know if you're doing a rapid sequence on someone? Don't you think you'd want to know whether they had 0 mils in their stomach or 500? Because that is just whether you still do the same anaesthetic, but you have more. You've gained more insight. You have more factors. You can't just go randomly.
You're just increasing your anxiety.
Mark, you can empty the stomach with a nasogastric tube for the lady who's about to have an emergency appendix. With her awake sitting up, you put an NG tube and empty the stomach and make it 0 or 10 or 50.
I accept that. That is a reasonable argument. But modifying my technique based on it, I don't accept those arguments at all.
I think it would cause less anxiety rather than more anxiety. If you've got a woman who you think may be a difficult airway, but technically needs a rapid sequence induction, and you're trying to make a decision, do I do a bog standard RSI to cover myself with cricoid pressure, which is what I think a lot of people do, because a lot of people, as we've discussed before, we don't think agree with it, but kind of just do it because it's the done thing and it raises eyebrows if you don't. Or you have a look at the ultrasound and think, oh, actually, this lady hasn't got anything in it. I'll allay my anxiety and go back to a technique, an airway, an induction technique that I'm really comfortable with, I'm more happy with, and I'm going to put that to one side and just concentrate on securing this airway.
Again, I'm always going to be more concerned about the airway than the stomach contents.
Okay, I'm going to be controversial and say there's two ways you can buy time here. One is you buy time for laryngoscopy and bagging, etc. The other is you fast forward the 6-hour waiting time in the situation where someone's had food. So I'm not talking about an emergency where the case needs to go on, but the situation where someone's had some food, you want to operate, and you wait 6 hours. Instead, you do a scan, empty their stomach, and carry on. How about that? That may not be there may not be the motive for this study, but there is a possibility here of buying time in more than one way because
or not casing, cancelling patients you haven't followed the guidelines. I think Mark, like it or not, we're gonna all end up. We're gonna carry around those TUI tests and adult gastric ultrasounds in 5 years' time. And
I think ultrasound is going to be a standard piece of kit in anaesthetic rooms because it gets used more and more for more and more things.
We can throw away our stethoscopes.
I love playing with the toys as much as the next man, but I really think people are grasping at ways to use it now. I think you'd need a lot of training to reliably predict in the way that they've described in this paper.
You're probably right. And I think you would then have to do it frequently and you'd have to be supervised. And, I'm sure they'd bring out 10,000 different forms for us to get signed, but it's still maybe
right.
on the horizon.
And then you're onto a loser if you rely on your own scan and it goes wrong, because people will say, well, since when were you qualified to do this? Since when has this technique been validated?
But you see, everything we do in medicine is a risk-benefit analysis. We have to make it, and that's our responsibility as a practitioner, to use a combination of the evidence that we've read in the literature and our clinical opinion of the particular patient to make a risk versus benefit analysis and do what we believe to be best for the patient. That's the essence of what we're meant to do every day. And I just think this is an extra piece of information. Yes, there's going to be a learning curve involved. But again, ultrasound's one of those skills. The more you use it, the better you get at it.
Well, there is. So show me a paper where a barely trained anaesthetist reduces the incidence of aspiration, as opposed to this, which is a sonographer in a lab with healthy patients.
It's a first step, though. Remember, we reviewed those papers from Australia where a barely trained anaesthetist was able to do a very basic echo on patients, and it altered their basic echo on
Royce work.
On patients who are having, I think they were NOF patients, and it altered their anaesthetic management, and they were barely trained anaesthetists.
But they're also the barely trained anaesthetist who pretends they know how to use a stethoscope to listen for aortic stenosis. I think there's always an argument that we're not experts in a lot of the things that we do. And I think this is just another piece of information. I agree at the beginning there is a learning curve. And you're right, if there's an expert sonographer challenging the barely trained anaesthetist, then they've got no ground to stand on. But it's a study which has taken a completely novel idea and shown some utility, albeit in the hands of the enthusiast. I think against that standard, it's doing reasonably well. And they've done it twice, and they've sort of improved their technique.
Although that being said, I do agree with Mark. It shouldn't be the only thing that you make a decision on, and that you then become overly complacent and overly reliant. You know, you've got five factors pointing in one direction, but your ultrasound points in the other. And I do agree. You shouldn't be, you know, totally blown away by it. But that's the same with any, you know, any number that we have. When you look on any variable with patients, you can't get too hung up on the value of one just because that confirms what you wanted to confirm.
And it's the same argument, and the same argument has also been going for the fast scans. I realise some people are better than others, but there's an argument that if we rely on fast scans and make a mistake, then that also has consequences. And certainly for, you know, epidural space identification and whatever else you want to use it for, you know, ultrasound of the larynx and what have you.
True. Although I... Don't get me started on ultrasound epidurals.
All right, that generated far more debate than I was expecting.
Was that Mark's monthly?
So that's good. No. We're gonna have to save it. Otherwise, we're gonna reach a point of tachyphylaxis with Mark's irritation to this month's selection of articles. So, in actual fact, Mark, I've got a quick announcement before we go on. So, once again, we've failed to realise the publishing schedule of our own podcast. But just quick announcement, we're going to GAT again this year to do another GAT cast. It should be very exciting. I think most of our regulars are going to be there, but Sibs, you're going to be there as well, aren't you?
I definitely am, yeah.
Going to be there, and June Rahman's coming back. So it'll be one of our live kind of recordings and should be a lot of fun. So I'm really looking forward to that. And we're sure to get some good interviews from GAT as well. So if you are there and you have listened to this podcast, which I know there's going to be a window of about 4 days to do by the time this is posted, but come and say hello.
I'll be thinking of you from Puerto Rico.
Oh, is that where you can't make it?
Yeah, I'm going to the soap meeting. I say I'll be thinking of you from Puerto Rico. Be lying on the beach at the soap meeting thinking of you, yeah. And where was the GAT meeting, sorry?
I'm sure Central Oxford in the middle of March is just exotic.
The meeting's actually on the beach, is it, Dr. Smith?
Yeah, my particular workshop is, yeah.
Very nice, very nice. So,
sand and obstetrics do not mix well.
Mark. What an image.
Beck, someone recently, you met someone on a course who listened to the podcast recently, and they requested the return of Mark's Monthly, did they not?
They did. They said it was their favourite feature and seemed quite put out that we hadn't had one recently. No pressure,
Fair enough. Mark. Are you?
It's difficult. I'm such a mild-mannered type person, it's hard to get worked up about.
So, Mark, are you gonna disappoint the listeners, or do you have something for us this time around?
I did get mildly irked this week, yeah.
Do you want to share your strife with the internet community?
Yeah, this week I received a group email from a hospital I used to work for, pointlessly announcing the introduction of a new product to try to reduce the incidence of intraoperative corneal abrasions. This was shortly followed by a discussion between a couple of consultants voicing their own concerns about causes and prevention of the aforementioned ocular trauma. Ultimately, the professional discourse was torpedoed by one consultant who chimed in to opine that the cause for the majority of corneal abrasions was in fact junior trainees wearing stethoscopes and ID badges around their necks, which inevitably hit the patients directly in the eye during intubation. Now, you might think that the reason for my outrage is this gratuitous trainee bashing, but I was actually able to laugh that off and resist the urge to fire off a witty reply. What actually annoyed me the most is the increasing prevalence of unsolicited pseudo-spam in the form of group emails and casual clicking of reply all. I haven't worked at that hospital for a long time, and I almost certainly won't work there again, so I never needed to hear any of this conversation, or indeed any of the constant stream of tittle-tattle that floods my inbox from seemingly every place I've ever worked. This is a particular type of insidious spam that is almost impossible to filter out for fear that every now and again there might be a legitimate email from one of these sources. I currently have 6 active email addresses, but I reckon that at least 90% of their inboxes is stuff that's just using up valuable time that I should be using to read proper emails and give due consideration to the wealth of penis enlargement technology available on the internet. Friends and colleagues, I am a deeply antisocial person. I almost certainly won't reply to or even care about your message, so please think twice before including me in your group or hitting reply all.
Oh, excellent.
Oh, that is one thing that does drive me mad, especially when if someone sends a congratulations and then you get about, you know, to someone who's done something or published something, and then every keen bean on the, you know, on the email list reply some really ingratiating email back oozing congratulations. You could just reply to that one single person, couldn't you, and say,
yeah,
fantastic job,
and CCing everyone just so that they know what you've been up to.
I'm going to put a feature request into Mozilla for Thunderbird now that they should make the reply all button red.
And that you should.
Some people use it more often so it stands out.
Get a little electric shock if you click on it, so you really have to want to do it.
But I don't mind people replying all if they say something really funny or clever. But when people just reply with a one word sentence, yes or no, or something tedious or repeating it, someone's got a witty, witty comment to share. That's fair game.
Do you mean if you've got a witty comment to share?
If I've got some shit to say, then I share all. Yeah, share to all.
I did think it was funny when this consultant came on to squarely blame the trainees.
We're not necessarily blaming trainees, but sometimes you do think these people have just got balls, haven't they? The stuff that they'll just reply all. So, you know, it doesn't seem to be that filter. So, yeah, take my hat off to some of them.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, thank you very much for bringing Mark's monthly back. Hopefully we'll have some more in the upcoming months. So let's move on to my article, which is, in fact, a case report. This March's anesthesia is all about, or the running theme seems to be PCAs with remifentanil. There's a randomized controlled trial, an editorial, and the case study, which I was just going to quickly mention. I think it's an interesting case study, and I think it will generate a little bit of discussion. So to quickly describe the case, which is very well written, it describes a 24-year-old woman who had sadly had an intrauterine death. She's fairly normal size and weight from the description, had been induced with some mifepristone, given some codeine and given some diamorphine, and then not really progressed by the looks of things. And then following a discussion with the anaesthetist, gone for a remifentanil PCA, for which they have quite a rigorous protocol at this hospital. I've worked at one place that had a remifentanil PCA, but it was very, very experimental. It was a few years ago, so it was kind of just one consultant who was pioneering its use there. But it seems that here they've got quite a mature and well-developed protocol for it. Gives you a bolus of 40 micrograms, 2-minute lockout, which seems to be fairly standard from the editorial I read accompanying this article. And after a period of observation by the anaesthetist, 15 minutes, 3 presses, I think, this woman seemed to be fine. She was using the PCA appropriately. The anaesthetist then left, handing over the care to the midwife. And then sometime later, only 35 minutes later, actually, after the start of the PCA, the patient's mother was seen to come out of the room shouting for help, and a cardiac arrest call was put out. Consultant and registrar turned up, found the patient to be in cardiac arrest, and noted a couple of things apart from the obvious cardiac arrest. One was that the patient had quite marked masseter spasm, which is something I think is worth discussing a bit later. They performed external cardiac massage, were able to bag the patient, but not intubate them because of the masseter spasm, and then performed and got the obstetricians in and performed an immediate cesarean section in the room, during which time she had a ROSC. The fetus that was already dead was delivered, and then I think moving forward, sort of taken to theatre, the procedure was finished up, rapid sequence induction was performed, a grade 2 view at laryngoscopy, and the woman taken to ITU. She had slightly abnormal ECG, but obviously that's going to be fairly common post-ROSC, and that reverted to normal later. She was woken up on ICU, thankfully neurologically intact, with no memory of the event at all, but it has led to the protocol being no longer used on that particular unit. It's an interesting case study. There are a couple of bits that I wanted to focus on just to kind of prime our discussion about this. One of the bits was the description, which I'll just read word for word, of the actual kind of precipitating event. 15 minutes after the anaesthetist left the patient and 35 minutes after the start of the PCA, the patient's mother shouted for help. The midwife was not in the room at the time, having left to collect another pessary. A cardiac arrest call was put out and the emergency buzzer sounded on labour ward. A consultant and a registrar anaesthetist were present on the delivery suite and arrived within a minute of the buzzer sounding. The patient was supine on the bed, unresponsive, GCS3, and deeply cyanosed. A small amount of fluid was present in the airway, which was suctioned. The patient was making no respiratory effort, and so manual ventilation was commenced with 100% oxygen using a bag and mask. No peripheral or central pulses were palpable, and external cardiac massage was started. The pupils were approximately 5 millimeters in diameter and equal. The patient's mother reported that the patient had suddenly turned blue, complained that she could not breathe, and had then become unresponsive. I just thought that particular description of the incident was very good and might be quite important. So I don't know what you guys think. I think it's quite a good mix of people we've got here, because obviously, Bex, you're an obstetrical specialist, and Sibs, you are a pain man.
A Remy hater. I've also worked on a unit where Remy fentanyl PCAs were quite commonplace. In central London, and the biggest issue was that not wanting to be midwife bashing, but there was a regular problem with ensuring the midwife remained in the room. So the policy protocol of that unit was that the midwife had to remain in, one midwife at least had to remain inside the, in the patient room at all times during use of the PCA, and that was never adhered to. And midwives would wander out and come back as necessary or as desired. And the other thing we found, I was only there for 6 months. We found there was massive difficulty in distinguishing between a sleeping patient and an apneic patient by midwives, and it was a recurrent theme on that unit. So the policy was stopped.
Sorry to cut over you.
What
really fascinated me about this case report was two things. One was the kind of, even in the academic language used in such a fine journal, you can kind of read that this was a total chaos type situation. There's monitoring missing and a wedge missing, and I can picture the scene quite clearly of all of
it. It is very realistic, isn't it?
I was going to say, it's really well written, and they really kind of describe the human factors, don't they, that come across in this.
Secondly, what struck me in the kind of latter half of this case report is how the blame is being very squarely parked on the door of the midwives. Now this line says, we have discontinued routine use of remifentanil on our unit as it became clear that our midwives are unable to provide the level of one-to-one care that is required. Indeed, it became clear during the investigation that the midwives' interpretation of one-to-one care and our own differed significantly.
But can I say...
Did they say that? Did they make that statement?
I actually think that's highly unfair because, first of all, there are many things that have annoyed me about this case. When people become apneic from a bolus dose of Remy, they don't complain and then become hypoxic, do they? People become sedated, they're drowsy, they hypoventilate, then they're apneic. So I don't know if this was... Are you convinced that this was a remifentanil incident? You do think someone who's got an intrauterine death, who's in preterm labour, who's labouring, is, you know, she's massively at risk of an amniotic fluid embolus. And don't you think that sounds much more like it, that you have amniotic fluid embolus, you have an arrest from that you become hypoxic? I mean, I don't understand how someone who's being sedated from remifentanil is going to complain of being short of breath and then sort of, you know, slump down.
Well, they say that at the time they suspected embolus. I guess
I think
you wouldn't see an amniotic fluid embolus. They look for a PE, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
a blood
difficulty
embolus.
Is that if the midwife had been present and the policy had been followed and the midwife had a medical description, so they're reliant on the description of the mother,
yeah.
which in this case is actually quite detailed, but it's almost academic whether or not, or the cause was the fact is that they've had to stop this policy because the protocol wasn't followed.
Yeah, if you look at most remifentanil policies, certainly four or five that are hospitals where I have worked where they have a remifentanil policy, first of all, if you've had any kind of intravenous or intramuscular opiates in the last 4 hours, you don't get to get the remifentanil PCA started. So, you know, really, she'd had the long-acting diamorphine and she had codeine, within the last couple of hours. She was started on 40 microbolus, so she's 87 kilos, but I worked it out, that's 0.45 mics per kilo, which anywhere I've worked, they've started at 0.25 mic per kilo bolus. You know, so they don't say about, you know, that they actually did start at almost the maximal bolus dose. There's all this issue about whether your hand is bent or flexed and you could actually end up giving yourself like a double bolus, you know, because of drugs stacking in your veins. They didn't mention where the cannula was, whether they had fluids running. And in those patients that have intrauterine death, certainly hospitals where I've worked, you know, there's that lilac room around the back with not much monitoring. You really isolated the patients that have had intrauterine death that have to labour. And while that is very sensitive to the patient, you know, there's a lot of incidences with those patients that it's probably not in their best interest to be stashed around the corner. You don't know whether she was, you know, she's probably in some sort of state of distress, not eating, not drinking. You know, if she was 31 weeks pregnant, she would have significant aortic cable compression if she had become drowsy and slumped down. So while I agree they should definitely have stopped giving remifentanil on their unit till they've investigated a bit more, I don't think necessarily blaming the midwives for a non-ideal protocol is the answer. And that's unusual for me to defend midwives.
I can imagine the atmosphere on that unit must be pretty frosty since this has been published.
Yeah. I mean, they do mention in the editorial, actually, there have now been quite a few case reports about remifentanil and cardiac arrest or respiratory depression in obstetrical practice. But I think one of the other ones was in an intrauterine death, and the question is, are this particular group of patients at higher risk? And I think they do mention those very good points you brought up, Bex, about quite often these patients are managed differently. They are a little bit hands-off with them, and I think that's a good point. One of the things that struck me when I read it, and obviously I'm not an obstetrical anaesthetist and haven't been near an obstetrical unit in quite a long time, but what I have had once is I've experienced wooden chest syndrome with a patient who'd had an anaesthetic and then was starting a remifentanil infusion as part of their TEVA and got quite a bit. And I did actually have a patient who briefly had a wooden chest, and it was one of those things you experience you never forget, because they were genuinely quite difficult to ventilate for only about a minute. Just had no chest compliance, and then we did stop the remifentanil and it very, very quickly came back and everything was absolutely fine. But this, just the description that the mother gave is quite interesting. You know, you don't, as you said, if you've got respiratory depression, you don't sit there and go, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. So I just wondered what people's feelings were about that. I know that in a similar case, in the correspondence, people had written in and said, could this have been wooden chest syndrome?
I mean, I don't know about that much about wooden chest at all. I know where I worked in Toronto, they had done a study looking at the side effects of two different drug delivery regimens for remifentanil PCA, and they did a controlled trial of putting one group on a continuous infusion and then increasing boluses as needed, and they put one group on a, you know, the other way around. So they kept increasing the infusion but keeping the bolus at the same rate. And what they found is that you get a lot more sedation the bigger your bolus gets, even if you keep your background infusion low. So the best, and what they considered at that particular institution, the safest way, was to actually increase the background infusion but to keep a small bolus of the 0.25 mics per kilo dose. So, you know, that, I do think that right. Nearly 0.45, you know, 0.47, whatever that patient had, it's a big bolus dose.
So adding the breakthrough requirements to the total, so to keep infusing as a regular thing rather than bolusing.
Infusion with small boluses, and if they have breakthrough pain, you know, if that is not sufficient, you increase the background actually, but you keep the bolus dose small. And I wonder whether that's to do with wooden chest or just sedation. I don't know.
I mean, wooden chest is something. So one of the only references I could find to it was in Sasada and Smith. It seems to be on induction, which this kind of is almost an induction phenomenon that we're seeing here, because it was quite early on and she'd not actually had a large total dose of remifentanil.
I'm a believer, but you do see it with large dose fentanyl. I've never seen it with remifentanil, but I'm not sure this is a similar situation. I mean, the description, the vivid description given by the mum doesn't seem to be of someone who's finding it. I mean, it just doesn't fit in with someone who's finding it difficult to breathe or is becoming progressively more unconscious. It doesn't really fit. I mean, I don't know what the description would be of someone about to, someone suffering from an embolus, amniotic fluid embolus. I'm not sure if they're necessarily behaving that way, but it certainly doesn't seem like someone who's receiving high-dose opiates.
Yeah, I always thought with opiates you would just kind of drift off to sleep. You wouldn't perceive that you were short of breath.
But that's why I say I think wooden chest has got nothing to do with being narcosed. It's a musculoskeletal side effect.
That's right.
So that's why I'm saying I think she could have wooden chest and so feel unable to breathe, although... Anyway, it's a bit of a shot in the dark, but I'm not the first person to have thought of it because there's some correspondence about it.
So, summary, midwives should only look after drugs they can spell.
Oh, no, I've got another summary, actually. Sorry, well...
Is it better than that one?
No, it wasn't. It was a sensible point. So my sensible point was about monitoring. One thing that we do pre-hospitally, or that we've been taught to, is to use CO2 monitoring in sedation. I did this just yesterday. Stated someone pre-hospitally to have a femur pulled. Quite painful. The technique that we use is to give them some ketamine, reduce the fracture, and then splint the limb. But pre-hospitally, obviously, there are AATB guidelines for pre-hospital anaesthesia and sedation, and the message is that you should use exactly the same monitoring and the same standards of care as you would in a hospital environment. But one of the things we do is use nasal prong CO2 monitors, which are excellent. So I'm used to, with sedated patients in the operating theatre, doing a Heath Robinson and getting a face mask, making holes in it, poking stuff through. You can get what look like nasal cannula that are very comfortable, but rather than obviously pump oxygen in, they're just detecting the breaths and detecting the CO2, and they plug directly into the CO2 monitor. And in a letter by Rob Sneed to do with another case, Professor Sneed, sorry, from the Peninsula Medical School.
Rob to his mates.
Rob to his mates, absolutely. But Prof Sneed makes the point that oxygen saturations is a slow and poor indicator. By the time your sats are dropping, you've already stopped breathing, whereas end-tidal CO2 is actually monitoring your respiratory rate. But it is difficult to do, although very easy if you've got this particular bit of kit, which is comfortable, easy, plugs in, it gives you an alarm much quicker than a saturation monitor should. And I've only ever seen it pre-hospitally, and it's something that I think could be used to great effect to patients on PCAs who are at risk of this type of event.
The problem is, even if you were using it in the labour ward, it would not necessarily be interpreted and actioned upon if the midwife wasn't in the room.
Yeah, but at least you can then monitor several people from a central station and have alarms. And it's giving you a warning, because by the time the cardiac arrest has occurred, it's definitely too late. But once someone stops breathing, that's going to be detected very quickly. And it's going to alarm as well. And you're ahead of the game compared to saturations.
Sure. No, fair enough.
Just asking, certainly where I've worked before, that you've on the crash trolley, there's always a wedge pillow attached to the side of the crash trolley. It was quite surprising to me that they didn't have that, or didn't put a pillow under the patient, or obviously hindsight is a beautiful thing, but I did think that it'd be one thing that you could potentially be fairly strongly criticised on, because that can make a dramatic difference in a maternal cardiac arrest, and they didn't seem to be too concerned about that at all.
Oh, no, I disagree. I think they were very honest in this write-up, and they said, we didn't use one, we should have used one, one wasn't immediately available, but we weren't really prompted to it, and we've changed our practice now.
Yeah, I absolutely, but how can they, but thing. That's fairly fundamental, isn't it, to obstetrics? You know, it's like the trauma and the C-spine immobilization in obstetrics, it's tilt. And I'm just surprised that there are still labour wards that don't have a wedge attached to their resuscitation trolley, because certainly I've never worked anywhere where there hasn't been one.
This is what I meant, though, when I said that it's quite clear to see in this very frank description of what happened that there was all sorts of flapping going on. That's how I interpret it.
And a series of errors, yeah. Sort of all the holes of the Swiss cheese were lined up, and yet the midwives are the ones bearing the brunt of it.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right.
I mean, I can exactly see it taking place, and I can see myself, you know, exactly the same thing. But it was just one thing that struck me as unusual, and that's a systems error. And, you know, like you said, it does sound like they've taken steps to resolve it.
But also tying back into my discovery of the month, so this is an example of a drug being used off-label.
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
There is clearly an alternative. There clearly is an alternative, which is morphine, and many other alternatives. So when the GMC rules do come in, it'll be very difficult to use this drug off-label, and I can't really see someone pushing to get this license and the effort that takes and the funding that requires. So this may well be an academic discussion.
It's a very good point, but I think we better end it there. Lots of interesting learning points in that case study, from pharmacology to resuscitation in special circumstances and human factors. But moving on, for our final article, Mark, you've been looking at the difficult area of prognostication in traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, feels like we've been talking for hours, so I'll try and keep this relatively brief. So yeah, I'm going to talk about a review article from last year in the European Journal of Trauma and Emergency Surgery, entitled Prognostic Value of Various Intracranial Pathologies in Traumatic Brain Injury. And this study caught my eye. I wondered if I could learn something new about what kind of brain injuries are worse for patients. I'm back in the pre-hospital field again, so dealing with this kind of stuff, and this caught my eye. So this was a study performed by some academics from Manchester who are involved with TARN, that's the Trauma Audit Research Network. And the purpose of their study was to assess the prognostic values of the abbreviated injury scale and the Marshall classification and various intracranial pathologies in traumatic brain injury. And what I mean by that is they wanted to construct a model using established data from TARN of what injuries people had and what their outcomes were, and see if they could attach any prognostic value to any of these individual factors to help with decision making and to guide future work. So the way they did this was a logistic regression analysis of 802 traumatic brain injury patients from the TARN database, looking at one key outcome, which was survival at discharge. So I thought this was a good opportunity for a little bit of revision for us all. So the abbreviated injury scale is an injury coding system, usually performed after a patient's been in hospital for a while, using all available diagnostic information or operative findings, and that gives injuries a code based on their anatomical location. So in this case, that would be brainstem, cerebellum, or cerebrum. Also based on the type and subtype, so hemorrhage and its various subtypes, or contusion or swelling, and so on. And also based on the size or degree of the lesion. Each code is then appended with a severity score, from 1 being the most minor to 6 being the most severe. The Marshall classification is somewhat different in that that's based purely on CT scan evaluation, and that's much more concerned with the pressure effects on the brain rather than anatomy or type of injury. So the investigators extracted all of these 802 traumatic brain injuries from the TARN database based on them having a brain AIS severity score of greater than 3 or a basal or complicated skull fracture. And they also looked specifically for patients who had some documented evidence of pupillary reactivity or the absence thereof. Because there have been several previous studies showing that is quite a useful factor. So what they then did is they broke down all of these patients' AIS codes into more descriptive terms that we would be familiar with, like cerebral contusion, cerebral brain swelling, cerebral hemorrhage, and then further into extradural, subdural, subarachnoid, also brainstem injury or cerebellar injury. They also then kind of retro-coded from the AIS codes into what they think the Marshall classification would have been. And already I'm confusing myself with the complicated maths, but it gets worse because then they did our old favourite logistic regression modelling to create...
You know, we talk about that so much now that I actually feel relatively comfortable with it.
Yeah, I still couldn't explain it in simple sentences, though, to somebody else. This is what worries me. It is in, you know, the majority of the papers I read now have some kind of logistic regression modelling, and it still confuses me. I remember a colleague of mine once gave a very succinct explanation, but I can never replicate that.
Shall I give it a go?
I'm sure Rick could.
Do it.
So, if you have a binary outcome, say dead or alive, and a load of factors that you've measured that you think are predictors of the eventual binary outcome, the magic of logistic regression allows you to generate a prediction model based on those various measured factors. You can then make a variety of different models with or without each of those measured predictors and see whether your model increases or decreases in accuracy, and hence the contribution of each individual prediction factor to the accuracy of your overall model. This then gives you an idea of which prediction factors are the most useful to measure.
That kind of makes sense with what I'm about to go on to. So these guys created a baseline model using simple demographics like age, Glasgow Coma score on admission, pupil reactivity, the cause of the injury, and the presence or absence of extracranial injuries as predictors. And obviously they can then test the model because this is TARN data, so they know what's happened in the end. And then they kind of one by one added these various AIS scores or descriptive pathological terms or Marshall scores into their model and compared whether that improved the model by looking at decreases in deviance or the area under the rock curve. So their results summarized, out of the 802 traumatic brain injury patients, there's nothing particularly surprising here. Median age of 39, 75% male, most commonly road traffic collisions and falls. Just over half of them had a severe traumatic brain injury, defined by GCS of less than 9. 70%-ish had normal pupil reactivity. Median injury severity score of 25, so these are severe trauma cases, 15% of which having injuries outside of the head. What I think surprised them was that the only factors that seemed to have a significant effect on survival, that's a significant negative effect on survival, were having an abbreviated injury scale of 5 or 6, so the top of the scale, a Marshall score of 4, so again the top of the scale. They're not surprising. But the only of the specific injuries that achieved significance were brainstem injury and brain swelling. And I think it surprised them. It kind of counter to some previous work. None of the hemorrhagic pathologies on their own particularly changed the significance. They tried to lump them all together and reanalyze, and still that didn't make any difference. The authors do point out some limitations. As with most TARN-based studies, TARN is a strange beast and does seem to have a bit of selection bias in that death is an automatic includer for trauma patients, whereas people who are in hospital for less than 3 days don't get included. So there's an obvious leaning towards the more severe there. They do say that the implications of their study are that brain swelling is a significant outcome predictor, and that further implies that our current management strategies are possibly not sufficient for dealing with brain swelling. And similarly, the brain stem is the most anatomical location, which does seem intuitive because of where it is and what it does and the fact that there are limited options currently for treatment of brainstem injury. Their overall recommendations are that we should maybe repeat this kind of work but putting more weight into multiple injuries because the AIS scoring doesn't really count for having lots of pathologies going on. They just take the highest score for this kind of study. Also, as with a lot of this head injury kind of work, maybe we should look at different outcomes such as disability or longer term outcome. So In summary, I suppose I'm not really sure what I've learned from this study. It is interesting. I'm always keen to see the tarn data that takes so much effort to collect being used for something useful. Did any of you guys manage to glean any more than me from this paper?
You made a good point about outcomes, though. It may be useful to look at other outcomes or even composite outcomes of recovery, quality recovery in terms of years of disability-free survival. So it's not just about a line being drawn in the sand and the number of people making it to that point.
Mm.
There perhaps should other look at other endpoints. And I certainly add to the real life, real world meaning of the results rather than just looking at the number of patients surviving a set period of time. Any thoughts?
I don't think it's going to. It's not a practice changing paper, but it's definitely a thought provoking bit of work. That's a rubbish sentence I'm going to take out.
I just saw all those numbers and
I was wondering whether all the thought had been provoked.
Yeah, sorry about that. I'd written quite a lot of notes, but no actual conclusion.
Maybe we should get the listeners to send in an ending to articles that we find it difficult to conclude.
Yeah, BYO ending.
So that leaves us one final thing to do before we sign off for this month and pack our bags ready to go to GAT, and that is to play Biology or Bunkum. Mark and Bex are obviously very familiar. Or Bex, I mean, you're at least conversant in the concept of Biology or Bunkum, I think that's fair to say. And Sibs, you are the second time you played the game. Know what you're doing?
This is true. I can vaguely remember, but I could do with a reminder. There's no harm in having a reminder.
There is no harm in having a reminder. So I am going to give you three science biology type news stories. And one of them is not true. The other two are true. But the one that is not true, there may be some kind of vague truth to it. And your job is just to spot which one is the bunkum out of the biology.
Perfect.
Got
Let's
it?
Go for it.
Good. All right, so here we go. Here is item number one. A ban has recently been passed in New York on supersized sugary drinks. A large retrospective data analysis from Harvard concluded that there were 184,000 deaths per year globally, which is the same as asthma, by the way, where excessive sugary drink consumption was shown to be an independent risk factor. Number two. Motor transportation has now become an evolutionary pressure in a phenomenon known as vehicular selection. Scientists in Oklahoma have been picking up dead swallows for the last 30 years, and roadkill numbers have steadily declined since the 1980s, even as the number of roadside nests has risen. The killed birds have longer wings than birds caught for research, and on average the caught birds' wings have got shorter. The theory is that shorter wings are better for a quick vertical takeoff and improved maneuverability. And story number three, scientists in North Carolina have built a series of brain-penetrating electrodes that allow rats to telepathically communicate, not just across small distances, but also across continents. By transferring the information collected by a series of microelectrodes, they are able to relay information between different parts of two different rat brains and demonstrate cooperative behavior between the two animals. So those are your three news stories. Ban on supersized sugary drinks. Motor transportation has now become an evolutionary pressure, or can rats telepathically communicate with the help of small colanders? Mark, I think as per usual, you should probably go first.
Cool. First one is bunkum, definitely.
Right.
I agree. The first one's definitely bunkum. There's no doubt about it. Fat Americans dying of cola drinks before they get to die from asthma.
Yeah, we can't even ban them in this country. There's no way they would tolerate that over there.
Fair enough. And Rebecca?
No, I think it's the rat thing that was bunkum. I remember in the news, they did try to ban them.
That's
but
a classic Rick red herring, but
overturned. No, but I've heard this. But what do you think? That's that he's just fidging. Oh, I don't know. No, I'm going with C.
You don't like the telepathic rats?
Yeah, not at all. It's not like rats telepathically communicating via microchips. This sounds like some kind of B-grade horror made for television played at 3 o'clock in the morning on Sky.
But it's too good to be true.
Yeah, tell her, Rick. Tell her.
It's so extreme, you can't have made it up.
This is exactly okay. The kind of stuff that Rick cooks up. You know, let's put it in perspective.
So, starting with number two that nobody liked, which I thought there was... I was surprised when I read this. It is biology. You're all correct. I was surprised that in the relatively small amount of time that cars have been around, obviously it's not to do with time, it's to do with the life cycle of the animal, but that they could become an evolutionary pressure, but they in fact have.
I thought that was going to be bunkum when you were talking. I thought you were talking about humans, but when you said birds, clearly remember when I first understood evolution, it was the story of the moths in Manchester during the Industrial Revolution, who over a few generations went from white to black as all of the trees became covered in soot and so on.
You had the same biology textbook for GCSE as I did, didn't you?
Yeah. And then I understood evolution.
Yeah, precisely. It's all explained by that one story. But yeah, it's much the same thing. It's a theory only, but as it says, there are more birds that are living close to roads around this particular area, but less of them getting killed, and those that are killed have a significantly longer wingspan than the ones that are caught for research. So obviously lots of factors in there that need to be thought about, but the theory is that it's due to the aerodynamics of having shorter wings, makes you more manoeuvrable and better able to get out of the way of these fast-moving cars. So that's biology. So on to the other two.
I'm so right. Bex. I can feel it in my bones. Yeah. I'm right. Just say I'm right,
I admire please. You. I admire you for going against Mark and Sibs, but
oh, no.
It's once again not paid off, I'm afraid. So
how come I'm like the dad of biology at Buncombe?
In fact, I've
every
got there's
time.
A brilliant there's a brilliant video online of two rats in separate boxes with what looked like tiny colanders on their heads, running around these things, pulling series of levers, and apparently coordinating their actions or cooperating with these kind of various
I need to have a look at this. Which
tasks
website is
yeah,
it on?
Yeah,
I'm blowing raspberries.
You've got to listen to the details, Bex. It was very tenuous, the level of communication that Rick described. If he'd made it up, he would have had them, you know, actually sending messages to each other. But it was just electrical signals. Tenuous enough to be true.
See, I keep getting swept up in the stories, whereas the rest of you have gone for this very bizarre analytical approach and keep winning. I just keep listening to the stories.
But anyway, that's apparently true, and we will link to the video online because it is brilliant. Well done, Mark and Sibs. The ban has recently not been passed, but was proposed. So there has been a large retrospective data analysis, which I think that might also be bunkum because the link to the page takes you just to an article which seems to have been pulled. But the story was that it was a retrospective data analysis, and it showed that, I think it must have been logistic regression like we were talking about earlier, but 184,000 deaths were attributed to excessive sugary drink consumption. And so there was a group of people in New York who said they should be banning these very dangerous supersized sugary drinks. And that was proposed, but the motion was not passed. So it was definitely bunkum.
It's like you don't need a logistic regression to find an association with death in America from the shooty gun consumption, but they won't ban them either. So
very,
very good.
Very good. Irrefutable logic there from Dr. Salmon. So I think that's a good place to end it. Our April podcast will be coming from GATT on the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of April. So hope to see you there. If not, thanks for listening.